And welcome back to Coast, Michael Cremo, our special guest this hour. And we're going to take your phone calls with him as we talk about forbidden archaeology next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Michael Cremo with us. Michael, wouldn't you love to have a time machine and go back into time to see what civilizations might have been there and how they got there?
Yeah, that would be really amazing.
Magical. What time period would you set the time machine for?
I'd like to set it right back to the very beginning and go through the whole thing.
Right before the Big Bang. I would love to witness that, because I still don't know what that was. Have you taken a stab at that, what the Big Bang is?
Well, it's very interesting. You know, we were talking a little bit earlier about the Vedic cosmology.
Yeah.
And it anticipates a lot of developments that modern science is coming to understand. You know, they've developed this idea of an expanding universe. That's basically what the Big Bang means, that the universe started out in a very small, dense state, and it began to expand somehow or other. And then they've also come up now with the idea of multiverses, the idea that there are multiple expanding universes. But if you look back in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, it describes that in the very beginning, there was a deity called Vishnu who was lying in what they call the cosmic ocean, causal ocean. And he was dreaming, and as he breathed out, universes would come from the pores of his body in a small state, and they'd expand. In other words, the idea of multiple expanding universes was there millions of years ago.
They're probably, they were probably right.
Yeah, I think so. Actually, I'm involved in a project in India now. It's called the Temple of Vedic Planetarium, where basically we're going to be taking people on that time machine ride back to the very beginning of our expanding universe, and they'll be able to experience that.
That's remarkable. And when will that be up and running?
That is a long-range project, probably a few years down the road. The actual construction of the building is there, but to do all the finishing work and come up with the exhibits and the planetarium theater and all of that is going to take some time.
Years ago, Michael, when we were talking about your earlier works, Forbidden Archaeology, you had mentioned a story, God, because this one is great, of these steel type or metal balls that were found deep down in the planet. Remember that story?
Yeah, that actually, we were talking about South Africa a little bit earlier. That's a discovery that was made in South Africa, in the Western Transvaal region near a town called Ottosdal. There was a mine where the miners were finding these round metallic objects. I call them metallic because I got a hold of a couple of them and got them subjected to a metallurgical analysis, and it turned out they're made of mostly of hematite, which is a naturally occurring type of iron ore. It's also a kind of a semi-precious stone. But the really interesting feature of these round hematite spheres, which are about 1 or 2 inches in diameter, was the parallel grooves that went around the center of each one of them. And the metallurgical company that analyzed them said they couldn't tell how these could have formed naturally. So you have to be open to the possibility that they were made by some intelligent being, but they were found in mineral deposits almost 3 billion years old, not million, but billion, which is really pretty amazing. Now, if somebody were able to convince me, you know, that there's some natural way of explaining these things, But, you know, I went to South Africa once. I met the chief mining engineer from the mine where these objects come from. And he showed me in his office a block of mineral from the mine with these round objects solidly embedded in the mineral and, you know, kind of halfway protruding out of it, you know, with the grooves going around the protruding objects back into the solid rock. They're pretty amazing little objects.
Sure is. Michael, let's take some calls here for you. Troy in Columbia, Missouri, first-time caller to get us started. Hi, Troy. Good morning.
Hi. How you doing?
Great. Thanks for calling.
I just like to say it's a pleasure to hear forward and open-minded thinking people. I've been enjoying this conversation.
Well, thank you so much. Michael's with you, so ask him a question, and let's see what he's got for us.
Well, I'm...
You there?
Yeah, excuse me. I'm just having some issues here. I'm a creationist, but not just of the world, but of the universe.
Okay.
I've got lots of issues with Big Bang. If I don't understand, through physics, how different planets would be going different directions in the same system if they were all created, with the same Big Bang. Everything ought to be going the same way. But I keep an open mind, and I listen to everything I can. And like I said, I've been enjoying this quite a bit.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that.
Well, I tell you, Troy, I also believe there's an intelligence that's responsible for what we observe around us. So in that sense, you could call me a kind of a creationist also. In an explosion, things are going from a center in all different directions. So, I think it's possible if from some central point there's some energy that's expanding. It would be expanding in all directions and carrying everything with it in all directions. So the fact that things are moving in different directions doesn't pose a problem for me. And, one of the reasons why many atheistic scientists object to the Big Bang theory is that it suggests there's some kind of beginning, some kind of origin, and that there had to be something before that.
Right.
And what would that be? I would say it's
perplexing, Michael.
Yeah, some kind of conscious, intelligent being that's responsible for the whole thing.
I'm beginning to wonder if any of this is real. If it's all just a figment. They say we could be in a holographic universe, a digital world. Maybe they're right. Maybe we're the creation of some artist or something.
I would say our world is very much like that as far as I'm concerned, that we're in an alternative reality that's been provided for conscious selves, individuals who are not really fit to exist where they should be existing, in a level where every conscious entity is harmoniously and lovingly cooperating with each other, not getting involved in so many disputes and conflicts and fights. I think we're in the alternative reality that's been created for those of us who want to try to dominate, control, and exploit others and compete with them. But just because something's a virtual reality, it's real. There's something real behind it, but it's not the ultimate reality. Like, we might be playing some computer game, but we've got an existence apart from that, that we consider to be our real existence. And the computer game or virtual reality system that we may enter, that's, it's got a reality, but it's not the ground reality or original reality.
Let's go next to Tom in the Bronx. Welcome to the show, Thomas. Go ahead.
Yes. I'd like to say that, that if there were earlier civilizations that had nuclear energy and they engaged in nuclear wars of a variety, it may have been wars that that had less impact. In other words, they killed the inhabitants and everything, but they had less impact than the type of nuclear energy you have around today. They had more simplistic nuclear energy. What did you think about that, sir?
Well, I think you're on to something there. When we were talking about descriptions of weapons resembling modern nuclear weapons that are described in the ancient Sanskrit writings, there are some similarities and there are some differences. And one of the differences is that they appear to have been made by some more subtle kind of science than we deal with today. But today, when we want to make a nuclear weapon, we have to mine uranium, we have to refine it in huge industrial complexes, and then you've got to assemble the weapon in factories and things like that. But according to the descriptions given in these ancient Sanskrit writings, the weapons like Brahmastras, which have an effect that resembles that of modern nuclear weapons, these were made not by industrial mining and manufacturing processes, but by the manipulation of subtle energies by mantras, sound vibrations. So I think you're right there that in ancient times they may have been dealing with another kind of technology in the case of these weapons and other technologies that they employed.
Michael, in the biblical city of Sodom and Gomorrah, do you think that was nuked? It sure sounds like it.
It does sound like what they were, fire and ash and everything were rained down on them.
Yep, and not to look at it, and it just sounded like it. Let's go to Bill, truck driving in Stockton, California. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hey, first I wanted to ask about a concept I have that's, kind of deep, for me anyways, and it borderlines on metaphysical, but, I just wanted to get your take on it. I've often wondered, with the tradition of Nibiru and Nemesis, the star, mm-hmm. Nemesis, and Nibiru, the planet, and from Sumerian mythology. I've often wondered, is it possible that the universe, as we know it, has a Mobius, like a twist in space-time, and Nibiru and Nemesis might actually be the Earth and the sun? And where the fabric of space-time is twisting, do you think we could literally be coming in close proximity to ourselves? Like, for instance, with Planet Nine, all this Planet Nine science, and they just discovered another planet with a highly eccentric orbit, and its axial tilt implies that there's like an Earth-type planet that's like 10 times the size, way at the edge of our solar system. And I can't help but wonder if maybe that isn't, if it isn't us.
What do you think of that, Michael?
Maybe
in another universe we could be there.
Well, anything is possible. I haven't really looked deeply into that question myself, but, you know, when you have, I mean, there can be very strange manipulations of time and space. I think just recently they've detected an object in our solar system that comes from outside our solar system.
That we captured somehow.
Yeah. So maybe we've been captured by some other system.
You never know.
It's like a Twilight Zone kind of situation.
Well, I kind of think that maybe if we're in other dimensions or if there are multi-universes, maybe we're there doing something similar to what we're doing now, and sometimes it overlaps. Who knows, huh?
Yeah, just like when you're dreaming at night, you go off into some whole other reality.
You do.
You're something else, and you're coexisting.
And it's very real to you.
That's right.
Let's go back to Bill. Bill, did you have another question?
Yeah, I just had another kind of more simplistic question. You know, have you ever heard of the Beringia incubation theory, where under the Bering Sea, there could be evidence of an advanced civilization that perhaps, you know, bridged the gap between Eurasia and the Americas, that, you know, as far as the Americas go, the land was extremely, in flux. Like, you know, we had three oceans. Like, Texas was completely under an ocean at one time, the Western Inland Sea. But anyways, in Beringia, like under the Bering Sea, there could be evidence of a civilization that perhaps sent, like, hunting parties and whatnot into what we call North and South America.
Very possible.
And eventually populated it.
Bill, I'm impressed with your knowledge of ancient civilizations, to be sure. And, Michael, in the 30 seconds we have before the break, it's very conceivable we had those kinds of civilizations out there. You've talked about it before.
Yes, I have. Marine archaeology is becoming a big thing because the archaeologists are beginning to understand that inhabited areas of the earth that were once inhabited are now underwater.
Stay with us, Michael. We're going to come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast and take final phone calls with you. Michael Cremo has been our special guest. One of his books is called The Forbidden Archaeologist. Another is called Human Devolution. The other is called Forbidden Archaeology. His websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Welcome back to Coast. Michael Cremo with us. Our final segment just ahead, where we'll take your calls next hour. We talk about the darkness, the incredible haunting story that occurred in Ohio. So get ready for that. And welcome back. George Norrie with you, along with Michael Cremo, the forbidden archaeologist. Michael, look into your crystal ball, and what do you see as the future of humanity?
Well, my ideas about this are very much influenced by my studies in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, which tell us we're in the age of Kali. According to these ancient writings, time is cyclical. And in terms of the cycles, there are basically four. They start out with a golden age where everything is peaceful and natural, no divisions. And then in the second age, things become a little bit more unsettled. And the third age, things become a little bit worse. And in the fourth age, the age of Kali, it's described as a time of increasing social and environmental disturbance. And actually, that's what we see around us. Increasing intensity of storms, volcanoes, tsunamis. On the social level, there's increased levels of conflict and violence in the world. I don't have to list all of the signs of this. Everybody sees it every day. on the internet, on television, in the newspapers. So it's a very difficult time that we're in. But just because it's raining, it doesn't mean you have to get wet. You can shelter yourself, shelter others, and somehow or other make it through. And it depends upon understanding that we're all beings of pure consciousness, ultimately. We're not just machines made of matter whose only purpose in life is to produce and consume more and more material things for the benefit of different social, political, economic, and financial interests. We all have a different identity. So if we can come to that understanding, then there's hope, even though it's a very dark age that we're entering.
What do you think of end times prophecy?
Well, I think there is going to eventually be an end, but then the cycle will begin over with a new golden age. The cycle goes on, just like the year. You go through winter, spring, summer, fall, then there's another one, another one, another one. But ultimately, we don't belong in the world that's governed by time. You know, like one of the callers was pointing out some of the strange things that could possibly happen in the world of time. But ultimately, as beings of pure consciousness, we're timeless. We're beyond all of these changes and threats of destruction and end times and things like that. As long as we remain on this level of reality influenced by the force of material time, then yeah, we're going to worry about future destructions, end times, and things like that. But when we understand that we're beyond time, we have no beginning, no end, then we'll be beyond all that.
Michael, is it conceivable that we had civilizations 500 million years ago that was not advanced, but they were here?
Yes. Yes, civilizations don't have to get involved in heavy technologies. You can have civilizations that are based on a very natural way of life that doesn't involve heavy industry. So yes, you could have a very simple kind of civilization. And many people are interested in that. There are intentional communities that people are forming where they're trying to do things on the basis of simple living, high thinking. They've become a little bit disappointed and frustrated with living in the midst of a huge technological, heavy industry-based civilization that is poisoning the earth, poisoning the land, poisoning the water. So there are people who are interested in forming alternative, intentional communities based on a different principle.
Let's go back to the phones now. Let's go to Gabriel in Santa Cruz, California. Gabe, welcome to the show. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sure thing.
Primo, I had a question, an idea about the underwater civilizations and the pyramids underwater off the coast of Japan and off of Cuba, and if there was any correlation with that tied to the ancient civilization of Angkor and Angkor Wat, Cambodia, and ancient extraterrestrial hypothesis, please.
Well, I think all of these things are ultimately connected. You know, I think there is an extraterrestrial element to things. I think there was an ancient worldwide civilization that was connected somehow or other in ways that we can't really understand today. You know, there are signs of that. You know, there's really a whole lot of similarity between the pyramid-like structures that we find in, among the Mayans and others in Central America, and the Egyptian pyramids, and the pyramid-like structures in Cambodia and ancient India. So there does seem to be evidence of an ancient worldwide civilization. The ancient Sanskrit writings of India speak of such things, that there was a worldwide civilization that existed millions of years ago, and it had an extraterrestrial dimension to it. People on this earth were in contact with extraterrestrial beings from other parts of our solar system and beyond. People understood that they had they were part of a whole cosmic hierarchy of beings, and that's reflected in the purposes of some of these ancient pyramid-like structures and temples.
What do you think of the work of the late Zechariah Sitchin, whose theories were that the Anunnaki, coming from another planetary system in our solar system, came in and seeded us because they needed us to be workers for them?
Well, I have some differences and some points of agreement with the work of Dr. Sitchin. I'll just concentrate on the similarities.
Okay.
Yes, I think extraterrestrial beings did have something to do with our presence here. I think he put the time of the intervention at around 300,000 or 400,000.
400,000 years ago. Yeah.
At the time of the ape-man Homo erectus, I would put the intervention far earlier than that, all the way back to the very beginnings of the history of life on Earth. I mean, there are many scientists today, even just recently, there was a publication of a paper where some scientists, including Chandra Vikram Singh, who I know personally, about panspermia, you know, the idea that the Earth was seeded with life very early in its history. I tend to look at things like that the intervention of extraterrestrial beings placing life forms on this Earth took place at the very beginning, not just 400,000 years ago. But on the basic point that there's some extraterrestrial element involved in understanding our origin on this planet, yes, I agree with that. And it took place a long time ago. And it also has to do also with understanding that ultimately the life forms on this Earth are vehicles for a conscious self that comes from some higher level of reality.
Next up, let's go to Carol in Seaside, California, on the Wild Card Line. Hi, Carol. Good morning.
Hello, George. I'm very pleased to talk to you. The other man, his name is Mike. I would like to have a question. If he knows anything about reptilians?
I think he probably does. Go ahead.
Yes. Yeah, the ancient Sanskrit writings speak of an intelligent race of reptilian beings called Nagas. And there are elaborate descriptions of them. They exist on this earth. They also exist in subterranean regions of the cosmos. So, yes, there are accounts that I'm familiar with in the ancient Sanskrit writings of intelligent reptilian beings who had shape-shifting abilities.
It's been an incredible journey for you, Michael, over these years, has it not been?
Absolutely, and I've loved every aspect of that journey, everything that it involves, whether it's the research, the writing, speaking with the guest on Coast to Coast and your good self, the whole every aspect of that journey has really been fascinating, and I've learned a lot from everyone I've encountered along the way.
It's been a great journey. Let's go next to Joseph in San Diego. Welcome to the program. Hi, Joseph.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
It's such an honor to speak to Dr. Cremo. I mean, the Vedanta, the Vedic literature is so, you could call it, I would call it scientifically, spiritualistically scientific, and I've never encountered any philosophy I've read. I've studied every religion in the world, and I went to India, and I practiced bhakti yoga. And my question to Dr. Cremo is, what would you say would be the most important thing you could tell folks in this on the earth? You know, the Vedantic literature has been there for billions of years, in this, and I'm not sure which predate this. The Sumerian predate Sanskrit. I thought Sanskrit and Vedic literature, the Vedas, were the oldest in the known world.
Well, I would agree with you on these points. Probably we have a lot in common, being that I'm also a practitioner of bhakti yoga. And as far as advice about what the most important thing is, I would say the most important thing I've learned is that I have to spend some time each day getting in touch with my deeper self, which I do through a process of mantra meditation. I meditate on the Hare Krishna mantra. But I think whatever it is, I'm telling people what I personally do, but I think everyone has to search it out for themselves and find something that gets them in touch with their deeper self and that deeper level of reality that we all eventually will come to.
Michael, we're almost out of time. Let's take one more quick call, and let's go to Tim in Spring Hill, Florida. Go ahead, Tim. We'll squeeze you in real fast.
I've got so much to tell you, a quick call is going to be tough to do it.
Okay.
If you go back to the very beginning, the first ever thing created was a proton. There were subatomic particles that were in existence. The proton would consume them, create energy. This is why atoms actually move. And it's a condensed pressure at that time. It's like the Big Bang. It's going to go ahead and create your neutrons. As that expands and your universe expands, you're going to get more and more matter. And right now, as matter still exists, it's still absorbing these subatomic particles, and that's what gives you your gravity. It's like a subatomic wind pushing down for everything. So our sun's pulling the stuff in at the center of the sun. All the particles pull in the subatomic gravity. They're particles, but as they hit the center of the sun, they compress. That's what keeps the sun going. You go into a black hole, you have all the matter streaming into the center of the black hole, but it's layered. So at the outside, it's just barely the speed of light. But as you go deeper and deeper and deeper, you have faster and faster and faster layers, one with inside the other, so you get a gamma beam coming out, and travel within a gamma beam can actually be faster than the speed of light.
Well, that is fast speed. We're out of time. Michael, thank you so much. Keep in touch with us, all right?
Definitely. Thank you very much, George.
You're always the best. Michael Cremo. Up next, we're going to be talking about a haunting in Ohio.